Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Governor Ron DeSantis is writing a new book that's generating more buzz about him running for president. Donald Trump's getting pilloried for dining with an infamous white nationalist. And the Florida legislature again is meeting in an emergency session to deal with property insurance. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson. And those are some of the stories I'll be discussing this week with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, that music means it's number picking time. Gentlemen, good to be back with you after the big election cycle here. We're looking forward now to a lot more political action at the end of this year and into the new year. We got a special session coming up. We got Ron DeSantis writing a book. Always lots of action here in Florida. Lots of numbers percolating. John, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, Zach, I do have a number. And now that we're into December and winter is coming, even here in North Florida, I'm keeping it low, like our winter temperatures. It's a zero.
Ooh, all right. Frosty. How about you, Antonio?
I can tell there are no winter temperatures in South Florida, guys. It's about 85, 89 degrees. But I'm going with 22, but it's not the year.
Well, like John, I also am getting low with my number this week. My number is one. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll let you know what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, fresh off his historic 19-point re-election victory, DeSantis is planning a new book titled The Courage to Be Free, Florida's Blueprint for America's Revival. John, the book title sounds an awful lot like DeSantis wants to bring what he did in Florida to the national stage in a future presidential administration.
Well, it does. It sounds like DeSantis thinks that the brand he's created in Florida, you know, can be taken nationally. I imagine the book will have its share of attacks on woke culture, you know, blaming corporations and universities for caving into people who want such revolutionary things as diversity and respect for minority points of view. You'll also hear a lot about what they want. Fighting the other in this country is a big part of what DeSantis is. This they will be people who want to indoctrinate children in sexuality and gender, and those that support care and treatment for transgender people. Another development of our society that DeSantis and his Trumpified Republican Party really wants banned. He provided a statement to Fox News on the pending book that seemed to promise that these wedge politics that he advances will be a central part of his story, saying that the quote was, Florida is proof positive that we, the people, are not powerless in the face of these elites. So there's, you know, Yale and Harvard graduated Ron DeSantis blasting the elites once again. But, you know, given that this is an autobiography, you'll also hear about DeSantis's Horatio Alger side, born of middle class parents and raised in Dunedin, loving baseball and using his athletic ability to get to Yale, where he captained the baseball team, you know, somewhat ironically, like former President George H.W. Bush did, but given again the hard right leanings of today's Republican Party, it's unlikely DeSantis in his book will draw any kinship with anyone named Bush.
John, you mentioned DeSantis's sort of humble upbringings, which could be part of this book. I wonder if that's part of the calculation here too. You know, he is not a wealthy individual. He doesn't have a very high net worth. Unlike a lot of politicians, unlike Rick Scott or some of the previous governors, he still has student loans. Is part of this, you think, he just wants to cash in a little bit, maybe make some money here, put himself on sound financial footing?
Well, there is a little bit of that. I mean, sure, you know, a well-selling book, I suppose, does bring in some cash, and an advance from a publisher for a guy like DeSantis will be significant. But, you know, remember, too, you know, he clearly has followers across the nation. You know, you don't raise more than $200 million and spend $100 million on your reelection campaign without a lot of supporters, including some very big ones. And he still has $90 million plus left over after his reelection campaign. So I think DeSantis's autobiography, you know, no doubt will portray him as someone with the ideas and the steel spine, you know, to stand up to the more liberal aspects of our society that really at this point fiercely animates and agitates the Republican Party, you know, while being a true American story of a self-made man is going to be what he is cast as in this book. If tradition dictates, it's an autobiography, not fiction. But image making is something that DeSantis appears very good at. And you know, heading into that last presidential election in 2020, kind of remarkable. Every one of the prominent Democrats looking to challenge Trump that year had a book out. But I still think my favorite title, at least, belonged to a candidate that's long forgotten, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. Remember him? He didn't last too long. He didn't get far. But his book's title, I thought, was unbeatable. It was called The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics. Yeah, that's a book I would read and enjoy with a beer.
You mentioned an interesting point there, John. There's a lot of aspiring politicians who release books. You know, Barack Obama did it before he ran for president and released subsequent books. And then I think DeSantis already has released a book, which kind of riffed on the title of Obama's book. But, you know, Marco Rubio released a book, you know, in advance of his run for president. Antonio, what do you make of this? I mean, a lot of people look at this as sort of checking a box for a presidential run.
Yes, it is. But gentlemen, before we go crazy with the DeSantis book, I'm going to channel one Donald J. Trump here. And just remind everybody that these days, no one sells books like the former president, especially as subject matter, and especially when it's either a tell-all or some sort of an in-depth take. In fact, yet another book about him, Confidence Man, by the New York Times' Maggie Haberman, debuted at number 2 on the bestseller list when it came out this fall. You know, also a top seller was a book based on audio recordings of interviews with Trump, and that was The Trump Tapes by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. You could argue, too, that Trump's own Art of the Deal is probably one of the most cited business books of the past, you know, 30 years or so. And if you write a favorable book about Trump and he endorses it, then your sales are going to go up. That happened with General Keith Kellogg's memoir. Now, Keith Kellogg, when you think about, you know, Trump year people, he wasn't one of the big names, but his memoir was languishing at like 14,000 something place on Amazon's list until Trump told his followers to read it. And then it rocketed to number 1 on the Amazon list of political conservative and liberal reads. Sometimes Trump's PAC gets involved, and that happened when son-in-law Jared Kushner published his memoir, Breaking History, and the Save America joint fundraising PAC reportedly spent $158,000 buying copies of Kushner's book, pushing that book's standing up on the bestseller list. So a question here is, what will be Trump's take on DeSantis' autobiography? Will he pan it, ignore it, bolster it? I think it may well come down to just how DeSantis treats one particular tweet in May of 2018. Yep, the one in which Trump endorsed him for governor. I'll be flipping ahead in my copy of the book to see if the governor's version, if the governor's version of that social media missive, how does he see it? Because something tells me that DeSantis' telling of that tweet, if he delves into it, will be far different than the one that Trump posted on Truth Social just this last month.
Antonio, I think that there's Trump is certain to have a take on DeSantis's book, and he's certain to probably point to his book sales against the governors. You know, he did that with the election results, where he noted that he had way more votes than DeSantis in Florida in 2020. Of course, you know, not really mentioning that a lot more people come out to vote in a presidential cycle than in a midterm election. But you make a good point. There's probably nobody in the country who is better for political book sales than Donald Trump. And DeSantis has a long way to go before he'll reach that level anytime soon. Well, Trump was presidential candidate for less than 2 weeks when he stepped into another major controversy after having dinner with Kanye West, who brought along white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. The dinner triggered a familiar pattern of Republicans being forced to react to Trump's actions. Florida's two U.S. senators both weighed in. Antonio, what's your take on the Trump dinner and how folks are reacting?
Well, Zach, even here in Red Florida, the so-called Trumpiest state in America, people were reaching for the Tums and the Alka-Seltzers and chugging down the Pepto-Bismol to douse the heartburn from that gathering. You know, the dinner itself was just a bizarre arrangement. You have Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, offering Trump the vice presidential spot on his ticket. Then Ye posting, maybe in feigned surprise, that Trump screamed at him. Really? Then there's Fuentes, who Trump has yet to denounce. Actually, Trump has actually been more critical of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he's used stronger language in calling McConnell a loser than he has hit the far right frat boy with. And now we have Milo Yiannopoulos, another extremist ne'er-do-well, telling NBC News that he actually organized a dinner to make Trump's quote-unquote life miserable. So I can tell you he certainly made life miserable for Trumpists here in Florida. I mean, you know, it's a major disaster when even the loyalists in the base demand to know why you're surrounding yourself with quote-unquote losers, as a former Central Florida campaign chairman from Trump's 2016 campaign told me. Look, we're used to seeing these controversies swirl around Trump, and the uproar usually lasts around 15 minutes until the next one. But this particular debacle has really caused deeper unrest, and I think for two reasons. One, a number of people in the base have told me that they feel iced out, that they feel that Trump has basically cloistered himself at Mar-a-Lago with people that are just toxic, and the gathering of Nick Fuentes and Milo Yiannopoulos, in their eyes, was just the most public of them because the players made it public. Second reason is that they're also worried about how badly all this is playing out looking ahead to 2024. They point out that the lesson of the 2022 midterms is that far-right actors and election denialism and calling January 6th insurrection as political prisoners is a losing strategy. And if you're going to win in the blue wall Midwest states, you need a forward-looking, broader appealing message. And as we slide into 2023, they're afraid that there will be candidates, maybe Mike Pence, maybe Nikki Haley, and of course, maybe Ron DeSantis, who will have that appeal, who will have that message. And right now, Trump is losing and wasting precious time. We've been reporting on the erosion of Trump's support for a while. Yeah, he still leads in many polls, but the top number he is drawing continues to slide backwards. At his height, Trump was at, what, 80%, 90%? Now he leads in the 50s in some polls and in the upper 40s in others. And then other polls show large swaths of people who just don't want him to see him on the ballot again. So rather than soothing those feelings of unease, spectacles like this dinner, deepen them. You know, as one Trump loyalist told me, there is still a long way to go to 2024, and the momentum is in the wrong direction for him right now.
Antonio, what do you make of some of the reaction from people like Marco Rubio or Rick Scott? You hear people condemning anti-Semitism and white nationalism and condemning Fuentes, but they seem to largely let Trump off the hook and sort of go along with this idea that he didn't know who this guy was. You don't hear a lot of direct criticism of Trump. I mean, there has been some. Like Mitch McConnell, took a pretty pointed attack on him and said people who have dinner with folks like this are, you know, in my opinion, not ever going to be elected president. We'll see what happens with that. Mike Pence said Trump should apologize. But then you have folks like Rubio, who he basically said, you know, Fuentes is evil. He called him an ass clown, actually. And, so he was pretty aggressive in his criticism of him, but not of Trump.
Well, what we can make of it is that the Mason-Dixon line on people like Mitch McConnell, Mitt Romney, Joni Ernst in Iowa, and people like Marco Rubio and Rick Scott and some of the folks I talked to this week, that Mason-Dixon line is basically the Florida border with the rest of the country. Yeah. In Florida, people are much less willing to criticize him, to condemn him for meeting with these guys. They'll rip Nick Fuentes and Milo Yiannopoulos and whomever. But the criticism of Trump isn't of him specifically, it's of the people around him. Like one of these people told me, fire the gatekeepers. You know, it's the people who allowed him to meet with them. You know, they don't criticize him specifically, but I think that what we can make of this is that in Florida, for political reasons and because this is Trump's home and because he has been historically so popular here, they stop at that line. But outside of the state, it's a different matter. And that's what the Trump loyalists in Florida are really worried about, is that in Florida, it's kind of this oasis where you don't really pay attention to what people in the rest of the state, the country are saying. And in the rest of the country, this is looking really bad.
Yeah. And it was interesting. Rubio said that he wanted to see Trump condemn Fuentes. I could be wrong, but I don't think he's said anything about him yet, has he? I mean, he said that he didn't know him, but he hasn't gone ahead and condemned his views, which is interesting. The former president seems to unwilling to criticize people who are his supporters, even if they have very troubling views. Well, Florida's troubled property insurance market didn't prove to be much of a problem for DeSantis this election cycle, but it's not something he can ignore. Companies continue to fail, drop policies, and raise rates, and the two hurricanes that hit Florida this year only made the situation worse. So lawmakers are holding another emergency session this year to pass property insurance legislation after the last legislation they passed didn't seem to do much to stem the problem. John, two special sessions in 1 year, that seems to indicate a pretty big deal that we're facing with this insurance crisis.
It does. It's bad. And yeah, as you pointed out, Hurricane Ian especially has really made things worse. More than a dozen insurance companies have either gone out of business or stopped writing property insurance policies over in Florida over this past year. That's made it difficult and costly to find insurance. Citizens Property Insurance, that's the state-backed insurer of last resort for many Floridians. Now, that has 1.1 million policies on its books right now. That's a lot. That's double what it was 2 years ago. And that poses a potential risk for taxpayers, but the population number is also a window into just how bad the insurance market is right now in Florida. People are turning to the state-run fund, which Republicans for years and again now are talking about trying to depopulate, as the term goes. But they don't like the idea of state taxpayers being on the books for insurance losses. But when the private market isn't there, you know, what are you going to do for people? They have to find insurance somehow to own a home. Also, the cost of reinsurance, that's insurance for the insurance companies, that's projected to rise by 10% next year. That puts even more pressure on the companies that are still in business. And, you know, remember, when we talked about Hurricane Ian, which of course devastated Southwest Florida, that's expected to have caused between $35 billion and $55 billion in insurance claims. That's one of the costliest natural disasters ever. So Florida lawmakers know that they have a mess on their hands that's going to get even worse in the coming year. So they're trying to stem this cascade of problems with, you know, yet another special session on insurance. Just to kind of recap, back in May, the legislature met and they steered $2 billion in taxpayer money into a reinsurance fund to provide more available dollars for companies if they needed it. But since then, Ian is expected to have already caused $10 billion in losses from the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. So that surplus has been drained down. That it had been about $12.7 billion, but it is draining down right now, and the fund may have to borrow money for this year and next to meet its required $17 billion on hand that it has to have for next year. So during that May session, some other steps were taken to provide money for making homes more hurricane resilient. Also, adding a new separate insurance deductible for roof damage that made homeowners pay more for roof replacements. And they also put new limits on insurance lawsuits. Now, when they come back in later in December, you're probably going to see some of these steps beefed up more. You're probably lawmakers are expected primarily to provide tax rebates for Hurricane Ian property owners whose homes were left uninhabitable by the storm. That's something that's relatively simple, but they want to at least provide that to people so that they're not paying property taxes on something that doesn't exist anymore. But the state's chief financial officer, that's Jimmy Patronis, he's recommended a host of broader changes that get into the world of insurance. And one measure he's talked about is an all-out ban on what's called assignment of benefits. That's a tactic many homeowners rely on, but which is viewed as driving up costs and is subject to abuse by what he's calling predatory public adjusters. That's basically you're basically hiring somebody to work the insurance company for you, and there that's been an area rife with problems and fraud. And another thing Petronas wants is a statewide prosecutor assigned to pursue cases of property insurance for fraud. So obviously there's a lot there and a lot involved in the problem, not the least of which is that Floridians are building or rebuilding in areas that are at risk of more storm damage. But Florida eliminated the state agency overseeing growth management back when Rick Scott was governor, and there doesn't seem to be any talk of bringing back such oversight again. House Speaker Paul Renner said legislators plan to look at what he called a kitchen sink of options when it comes to tackling property insurance. But then again, he also cautioned people not to expect insurance rates to go down in the near term. So that's where we're at again. You know, two special sessions on the same subject in a year, that's kind of unique. But then again, Hurricane Ian was a unique storm on top of an already man-made disaster of property insurance in Florida.
Yeah, and one thing I think that Hurricane Ian really showed is that people need this insurance. I mean, we live in a very precarious state where, you know, we're just one natural disaster away from being wiped out, having your life savings wiped out and really relying on your insurance company to save the day here. And you just look at some of the images from especially the Fort Myers area, but even up to north from there to near where I live in Sarasota, there was just massive damage, roof damage, flooding from rivers, from 20 inches of rain. I mean, I did a little bit of hurricane reporting right after the storm and interviewed somebody in their business where the roof had come completely off, just ripped off. And they were just standing in the middle of a business that had four walls and no roof and blue sky overhead. So this is important stuff for people. This is their lives. And in the past, the legislature has considered some things that would make it harder to access your insurance policy, that would make you pay for more of a roof replacement, that would just push some of these costs on to homeowners. That is not going to help people. It might make their insurance, less expensive in the short term. But when you need to replace your roof, you got to pay a lot of extra money out of pocket. Sure. That could be a massive financial burden. So these issues tend to be pretty arcane and kind of difficult to opaque for people to really understand, but there, I think Ian really shows how critical this can be for people. So something that we'll be watching closely. We'll move on to some numbers here. Antonio, you want to tell us about yours?
Yes, gentlemen. I had 22, as in the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And I'm bringing it up because Trump's 2024 candidacy brings up the 22nd Amendment. The amendment was passed during the Harry Truman era in response to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's four consecutive winning elections. And it basically term limits presidents to winning two elections. That's it. You can only win two elections. Nothing about consecutive, just two. So that means should Trump actually win the White House in 2024, that would be his second election, and he would automatically be limited to just one term in office. I wrote a short story about this a few weeks ago, and I've had quite a few people react to it and point out that this is kind of a consideration for them. Because strategically speaking, you want to elect someone who can serve two consecutive terms for a number of reasons, especially longevity. In fact, in the past century, of the 15 incumbent presidents who sought re-election, only four lost. That, of course, includes Mr. Trump. This is all a constitutional and historical footnote right now. But as we get closer to 2024, I'm willing to bet we will be hearing a lot more about the 22nd Amendment as a campaign issue.
All right. How about you, John? What's your number this week?
Yeah, Zach, remember I had that frigid zero. Well, zero is the number of women in the Florida State House that were given committee chairmanships under new House Speaker Paul Renner. Chairs of 10 major House committees were announced by Renner shortly after lawmakers met Thanksgiving week for the organizational session of the legislature. It's only a one-day gathering, but the talk of the all-male lineup of leaders that was unveiled, well, that talk is lingering. You know, some on Twitter have likened it to the old Soviet Politburo, a roster of older white men. But I think many people are just sort of gobsmacked by the optics of it. And you know, this comes after the House Speaker's office was crowing about how 24 Republican women were elected to the House in November. That was a record number. There are also 3 black Republicans elected, also believed to be another modern record, and 15 Hispanic members. But yep, there are no black Republicans in the committee chair lineup either. And in fact, the only sign of diversity is Representative Danny Perez, who is in line to succeed Renner as speaker in 2 years. He drew the Rules Committee assignment as chairman, which is a little bit of an automatic role for the next speaker to play that role as Rules Chairman. Indeed, I guess, you know, tradition has something to do with this, evidently. I'm saying this because we've been unable to get any comment out of Renner or his office about the decision to name only middle-aged or older white men to chairmanships. But, you know, most of these 24 Republican women that were elected to the House were just elected. And freshmen are customarily excluded from chairmanships. So I'm assuming Renner could point to tradition as limiting his choices and elevating the likelihood that we'd get this male lineup. But several veteran House Republican women were bypassed for major committee chairs in the opening round. Now, social media discussion among some people close to Renner seems to indicate that, well, you know, like, wait, you're going to see women named to some key roles. That seems to be the assurance from some of Renner's allies. But, well, you know, we'll just have to wait and see at this point. But, you know, in a year when the future of abortion rights in Florida, for example, that could be decided with more restrictions expected, it does seem to be a misstep by Renner. At least just the optics look bad to not appear inclusive with his top committee posts. Now, you know, we do have a situation where a woman, Senate President Kathleen Passidomo, she's a Republican from Naples. She's leading the Senate, and she's only the third woman in history to lead that chamber. The House, by the way, has never had a woman speaker. But you know, I've been around this Capitol long enough to remember the last speaker to also have a lineup of only men as his committee bosses, and that was Democrat Bo Johnson in 1993. Well, Bo was blistered for that decision 29 years ago, I'll point out. So, you know, this is not just an example of, you know, 2022 woke politics. It was a big deal 30 years ago, almost. The annual press skits that year, the satirical theatrical show that's put on by the Capitol Press Corps, similar to Washington's Gridiron event, they lampooned Johnson that year with a song that was done to the tune of Broadway South Pacific's There Is Nothing Like a Dame. You know, with the press corps that year, all dressed in caveman costumes. So after Renner's selection, I don't know, it looks like it could be time for a revival of that show.
I can't wait to see that, John. I hope you'll have a starring part. I mean, a cynic might say, John, it doesn't really matter who the committee chairs are in the House. It's just a top-down operation. Doesn't Renner just, like, control everything with, like, 2 people and, like, you know, the committee chairs don't really have any authority anyway? So, like,
well, I
matter.
Think, I think you just broke the code. That's probably true. So maybe it doesn't really matter after all. But,
exactly,
you know, there is something about, you know, having a little bit of diversity at the top. And, of course, Renner, I think, sort of he underscored it by sending out a photo of the lineup. And the photo was obvious. Hey, these guys are all, you know, middle-aged men or older.
Picture says 1,000 words, right?
Exactly.
Nice. Well, my number is number 1. That's the number of Democrats who were consulted before Governor Ron DeSantis suspended Hillsborough County State Attorney Andrew Warren. DeSantis' public safety czar, Larry Keefe, revealed this information this week under cross-examination during a trial where Warren is seeking to get his job back. As part of the effort to be reinstated, Warren is seeking to portray his removal from office as politically motivated rather than done out of concerns that he wasn't upholding the law, which is the reason that DeSantis gave. So establishing through his testimony that Democrats largely were left out of the investigation into Warren's record could help the state attorney convince a judge that this was really more of a partisan effort to remove a prosecutor they didn't like. The only Democrat consulted was the Orange County Sheriff, Keefe said. That got Judge Robert Hinkle's attention. Hinkle dwelled on this point during the hearing, asking Keefe, quote, "You can't give me the name of a single Democrat you talked to besides the sheriff of Orange County." So he really seemed to be, interested in that line of criticism. Other evidence has been submitted that could bolster Warren's case that there were partisan motivations for removing him. And one example is that a list of pros and cons developed by the governor's staff for taking action against Warren included a pro that said removing Warren could ensure, quote, "a leftist prosecutor is removed from a position of power." Statements like identifying a leftist prosecutor sort of smacks of politics, not simply upholding the rule of law. Whatever happens with Warren's trial, it's providing a fascinating window into the inner workings of DeSantis land. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.